Welcome to Newborn to Teen and Everything in Between, the podcast from Bespoke Family. I'm Bex.
And I'm Claire. Thanks for joining us as we tackle the ups and downs of life with children, helping you to get the best out of your time together. No rules, no judgment, just guidance. So grab a cuppa and let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Newborn to Teen and Everything in Between. Before we start, I just wanted to quickly give a bit of a trigger warning in that today we're going to be talking with Hannah from Sweda, which is a charity which supports people affected by eating disorders. So if this is something that is going to affect you, please don't listen today. Look after yourself, and perhaps when you're ready, come back and listen another day. So without further ado, we'd just like to welcome Hannah Mackay from Sweda. I hope I've said that right. Sweda, what does it stand for, Hannah?
We're actually so Sweda, but...
Oh, Sweda, sorry.
Yeah, we're answer to most things though, so don't worry. So it stands for South and West Eating Disorders Association.
And you support it, not just children and teenagers, is it? It's people of all ages.
Yeah, so now we support anybody who's affected by an eating disorder, difficulties with eating, body image, anything like that. We can support the individual who's experiencing those difficulties, but we can also support friends, family members, anybody who's affected by anything to do with food, eating, body image.
Okay, so maybe it would be a good idea if you would perhaps start by just talking a little bit about you and about your background and just a little bit about the charity and how it was set up and the kind of work that you do.
Yeah, of course. So me personally, I'm a trained counsellor and clinical supervisor. I've been working with children and young people all my working life. It's something that I always wanted to do from quite a young age, actually. And I came to Sweda 4 years ago now as the children young people's lead. I started my first day at Sweda was the day after Boris announced the second lockdown in January 2020 around. So I was expecting to go into the office for my induction, and instead I was at home with now three children also at home starting a new job. So that was how I landed at Sweda, but kind of testament to the team at Sweda that it was 6 months before I went into the office, but actually I felt like a real part of the team, even though I'd not been with any of them kind of face to face for that long. It's a fantastic team. As an organization, Sweda started about 30 years ago, and it was originally set up by some parents of a young person in Somerset as a support group for parents. And it's kind of evolved since then. So we've obviously grown quite significantly since then. And we've done a lot of growth in the last few years since the pandemic. So now we have in Somerset, we offer an all age service. So technically we can work with people from the age of 4 or 5 right up to 80s or whatever. In Somerset, in Bristol and in Oxfordshire, we work just with adults at the moment. We do a little bit of work with children and young people in the BNSSG area. So Bristol, more Somerset, Gloucestershire area. And a little bit in Bath, but we don't have a great deal of funding for that at the moment. And how we work, we have, obviously we're an independent charity, so we're dependent on donations, but we also have several partnerships with the NHS in each area. So for example, in Somerset, we have a partnership with the adult NHS team, but also for children and young people, we have a shared pathway with the CAMHS Eating Disorder Service in Somerset, and that's been a real success. So on that pathway, we're seeing children, young people who perhaps don't now quite meet the criteria for the CAMHS service, or for whom it's felt that kind of a more person-centered, sort of more holistic way of working would suit them better. So they come to SWEDA, there's no waiting list and there's no limit to the number of sessions. So it's been a fantastic service and has led to a lot of improvement for CAM's response to treatment times. And also it's also helped SWEDA as well, obviously with the funding that we get from that.
I read that you also specialise with autistic children yourself.
Yeah, so we as an organisation over the last few years have done a lot to make ourselves more autism friendly and generally better at working with people who are neurodivergent. There are really strong links, particularly with autism and anorexia, but autism and various eating disorders, they kind of go hand in hand quite often. So it's really important that we have improved how our offer to people who are autistic. So all our staff are trained to work with autistic individuals. Obviously, all the staff working with children and young people are specifically trained to work with children and young people and with eating disorders. And our therapy rooms, we have one room which is specifically set up as a low sensory room. So for our neurodivergent clients, it's their SWEDA's colours are quite vibrant and bright, but this room is much more low key. There's lots of different kind of sensory, sensory kind of toys, sensory things within the room that people can use if they want to.
So when you talk about eating disorders, I suppose everyone will have an awareness of anorexia and bulimia, but I'm assuming it's a much wider spectrum than just those two that probably are most spoken about.
Yeah. So you've got the ones that are well known, anorexia, the bulimia, maybe binge eating disorder people may have heard of. And those have a diagnostic criteria. For people to come to SWEDA, you don't need a diagnosis. So it's anybody who's experiencing kind of those kind of symptoms or disordered eating. So maybe irregular patterns with their eating. Mm-hmm. Also there is now quite a lot coming through with people with sensory issues to do with eating. So there's an eating disorder called ARFID, or avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. That's those people who have very specific likes and dislikes and tastes and are very affected by sensory issues to do with eating. There's lots and lots of different types of eating difficulties. Orthorexia is another one, where people want to eat just very healthy, kind of clean eating. There's all sorts of connotations. So we have the named ones, but also we have people who maybe don't fit the diagnostic criteria for those specific eating disorders, but nonetheless are having real difficulties with their food intake, their thoughts around food, eating, body image as well.
Yeah, I was having a conversation yesterday with someone, and we were talking about how challenging it is when you have maybe an issue with alcohol or you have an issue with smoking and things like that. They aren't what your body requires every day. There's not a need to, whereas when it comes to food, there's a need to eat every day. And if there's an issue with food, whatever that may be, that is a huge challenge, isn't it? To every single day be hit with this reoccurring, you have to keep dealing with it. Whereas other things, and I know alcohol, smoking, all those sorts of things are incredibly challenging and bring their own challenge. But I think it's the fact that you have to eat and your body needs you to eat. And if you find that difficult, I just can't even imagine what that feels like each and every day.
Yeah.
Kind of having that battle.
Yeah. It's so true. And not only do you need to eat to fuel your body? So if you, for example, if you're restricting your eating, that can hugely affect you in different parts of your body. It affects how your brain works. So people who are in starvation mode find that their thought processes change, so you can become a lot more black and white. It's very hard to read other people's emotions. It's very hard to read your own emotions. If your body is used to being starved of food, you lose all those cues about when you're hungry, bizarrely. So it can have a lot of physical effects on our body. But also it's the social side as well. So, you know, we live in a society where food is very much a part of our socialising a lot of the time. So socialising with friends might involve going out for a meal. It might involve going to somebody's house to have drinks or food. Or say, if that's something that you really struggle with, it can be so hard and it has a huge impact on our whole life. You know, we hear regularly of children, young people who are struggling with eating, and it means that their social life kind of disappears because they try and avoid any situation where they might be exposed to having to eat in front of other people or to having to eat foods that they're not comfortable eating. And then as a parent, seeing your child having these difficulties also has an impact on you, A, because you're worried about your child, whether they're restricting, so whether they're starving themselves, whether they're overeating, binge eating, and the kind of side effects of that. You see your child struggling, you see your child at mealtime struggling, you see your child socially struggling, maybe going to school, lacking in energy, all the physical side effects. And that really impacts you as a parent, because as a parent, right, you want to look after and nurture your child. You want them to be happy, be healthy. And you know, to see your child struggling with such a fundamental need that humans need to eat to survive is devastating. It's really hard to deal with.
And so looking at that, if you are a parent and you start to think, what are the signs that you might be looking for that your child might be struggling or might be on the verge of that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think the first thing for parents is that these illnesses are really secretive. So it is really hard to see it happening often at first. And we often hear from parents a lot of guilt that they didn't realise that their child was struggling, and a lot of self-blame. But actually the nature of the illness is to keep it hidden and quiet. So it can be really hard to spot the signs. Things to look out for are... sort of if your child becomes secretive about their eating, if you notice that your child is telling you that they've eaten earlier or they're going to eat later, you know, it's quite usual to try and sort of avoid meals. At meal times, if they become very particular, if they want to know what's going into the meals, if they want to cook it themselves all the time, if they take a long time to eat their foods, lots of chewing or cutting it up into small pieces, and meal times are becoming longer and longer, more dragged out, those kinds of things. From a behavioural perspective, you might notice that they become a little bit withdrawn, that they are shutting themselves away a bit more, perhaps not talking to you as much as they used to. Maybe they're struggling to go into school or to do things outside of school. Physically, they might be more tired and lethargic than they were previously. You might notice that they feel the cold a lot more. You might notice that they get aches and pains in various different places. And I guess emotionally, your child might become maybe... you might notice a change almost in their personality. So they might become a bit more scratchy, maybe a bit less tolerant. They might become very secretive. It can feel like sometimes that your child has kind of just changed, and it's sort of maybe sometimes a bit hard to put your finger on it. And all those things may happen anyway, and it might not be anything to do with eating. There might be other stuff going on for them, obviously. But those are just some of the things that you might notice. And actually what's going on for your child or for anybody who's having difficulties with eating, often it's described as having like a constant bully in the room with you. So they might have kind of like a voice, I guess, in their head telling them what to do, telling them not to eat. If they do, perhaps giving them a really hard time, making them feel really guilty, just constantly there, constantly on at them. And it's really hard to live with, and it can kind of take over, and it can become kind of just this ever-present thing in your head that you're constantly dealing with all the time. So it can affect your concentration, it can affect everything. Even if you're restricting, you might find that you're constantly thinking about food and eating and meals. It's quite common for people with anorexia or restrictive eating to enjoy baking and cooking for other people and then giving it away, but then obviously not eating it themselves. It is a really tough illness to deal with for everybody.
And you mentioned that Sweda look after children as young as 4 and 5. And that surprises me. You know, how can you at that young age start to know? I mean, that's a young age to notice, isn't it?
Yeah. So we don't see many children that young. Most children, young people that we see are sort of mid to late teens. We have seen the odd child who is, I think the youngest that I've worked with has been 7. And at that age, it's more the children that I've worked with at that age to do with eating has been more to do with sensory difficulties around eating. And so there might be neurodivergence present. And so it's more about sensory issues or anxiety around eating. Now, Sweda, and generally there are currently no nice guidelines for working with ARFID or other sensory issues around eating. So as an organisation, Sweda at the moment don't have the expertise to work with ARFID and other sensory issues. We are constantly looking into it. We're currently evaluating and trying to come up with a pathway whereby we could treat people with ARFID or other sensory difficulties. But what we can do at the moment is if there's a presentation of a lot of anxiety around food or around meal times, we can work with that. So with this 7-year-old that I worked with, that's exactly what we did. And we looked at her wellies and about trying different foods. We looked at her wellies about meal times. And at that age, obviously, a lot of it is through play. So we did lots of different activities. And by the end of our work together, she'd got to a point where she had a list of new foods that she wanted to try. And each week she was trying a new food. And so we kind of came at it from the anxiety perspective rather than, because sensory issues with food and eating have a different root cause to the eating disorders such as anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, which is to do with shape and weight. Sensory issues have a different root, so very different ways of working with them.
With regards to, and going to the kind of teenager stage, and like you said about the anorexia and bulimia and the size and the weight, can it also be related to kind of, there's so much going on when they're a teenager, there's so much, and I'm just thinking about one particular kind of teenager that I knew. It was kind of an element of control, of being able to control something, because exam pressures, school pressures, whatever it might have been. And this seemed to be the where they could gain the control and feel more kind of, I've got this. Everything else is feeling really out of control. And so it was sort of the calorie counting, the restrictive eating, but it wasn't so much about weight or the look that she, you know, they were going for. It was more about that element of gaining control over something, over life, I think.
Yeah, and very often that can be how it starts. So aspects in life, be that just teenage life and what that brings, be that whether there's been trauma present, often it can start exactly as you said, as a need to feel in control of something. Because, you know, particularly as a teenager, you're constantly being told what you should and shouldn't do, where you should and shouldn't be by parents, by teachers, by everybody. It's, you know, it can feel like you don't have much control in your life, can't it? So, well, often it does begin with an element of control to it. So we hear very often that it started off as this was something I could control, that I was in control of. But then often it kind of spirals, so it turns over time to become that actually it was something that they could control, but then it becomes something that actually they don't have control over, and it starts to almost control them. And then that can be really difficult to then get to a point where you realise that and actually you're not in control anymore, and that you need help with it. And that's a really difficult step to take. And it sometimes takes a long time to get to that point that actually, I can't do this anymore. I can't control this myself. I can't, you know, I need help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what does kind of the help generally look like? And I know that we're talking about our area and where you're working, which is, you know, amazing, but I don't think it's the same across the country. And so what does the help look like? What does a parent do if they have that kind of concern or worry? Where do they start?
Yeah. So the first thing for parents to start with, if you're worried about your child and their eating, is to take them obviously to the GP for a checkup. Just to make sure that there are no underlying issues going on, that physically get an idea of where they are. Then in terms of support from SWEDA, it's about contacting us. You can do that through our website, www.swedauk.org, or you can phone us. Anybody can refer to SWEDA. You can do self-referral, parents, family members, schools, GPs, school nurses, anybody. Then once you come into SWEDA, you'll receive a triage call just so that we can get the basics of what's going on for that young person. Then you'd be offered an initial support and guidance session, which is the first meeting that we have with people. That's there for us to find out a little bit more information about what's going on, get more details about how it looks for that person and how it's impacting them, and to decide if SWEDA are the right organisation to help that person, because we're not always, so sometimes we have to refer to different organisations, and then to talk about kind of the way forwards. And then at SWEDA we offer various levels of support, so from low level emotional support calls, which are a half an hour call with a support worker. That offers, as I say, lay-level emotional support, maybe some practical advice. A lot of parents take that up because it gives them space to talk about how they're feeling, but also it gives them space to get some hints and tips on how to support their child. Mm-hmm. Then we also offer counselling as well, again, to the person experiencing difficulties, but we can also offer counselling to family members as well if they want it. We have support groups as well, and our website has got a load of resources on that can be really useful for people to look at too.
Do you find it impacts siblings? Because, like we talked about, the whole thing of sitting around the table, going out for meals, and as a family, do you often find that you're supporting, as you say, the whole family, but also if there's siblings involved, it can kind of impact on those relationships?
Yeah, I'm sure it does entirely. As you say, it kind of comes in and it, rest, the person who's experiencing the difficulties is obviously finding it really hard, but actually it does impact the whole family as well. And because often parents are very concerned about their child who's having eating difficulties, so a lot of their attention, a lot of their time goes towards that child to, you know, to support them. And it's hard for parents to juggle. And so sometimes other siblings can feel left out or forgotten about. Sometimes obviously siblings see their brother or sister going through these difficulties. Sometimes it means that they later on develop similar difficulties. It can impact the whole family. We don't tend to work with that many siblings at SWEDA, although it is there if siblings want to. We tend to do the support through parents to help them, not only with the child who's having the eating difficulties, but kind of just in general for the parents to then help them manage, you know, the whole family.
Yeah.
So, Hannah, obviously we've just been talking about, you know, siblings and that kind of thing. I think one thing that people find it really hard to kind of work out what to do is what to say. I mean, we've got friends, you know, people, you just sometimes you don't know what to say. You know, you kind of think, I'm going to eat this, but then you think, oh, should I be eating this? Because, you know, am I going to upset some, you know, it's really tricky to know how to behave or what to say, what to talk about, or even just how to behave as a parent in front of your children. You know, how do you role model correctly? You know, how do you not get into an argument about things? What's the best thing to do? Even actually, not just if your child, you know, your child is going through this, even if you're just thinking, I'm a bit worried about this, what, you know, how am I supposed, what should I be doing?
Yeah. So I think that one of the things that we always say to parents is to, and I say this knowing that for me sitting here, it's very easy to say it. When you're in the situation, clearly it's very much harder. That is to just try and keep things as, quote, normal as you can. So if you're a family who normally sits around the table to eat, try and keep doing that. If you can try and keep up conversations that you would have had before this illness came into a house, so be that talking with everybody about their day, be that whatever you do as a family, to try as much as possible to keep those norms in place for you, for any other children, but also for the person who is experiencing these difficulties, because they need to know that actually there is life outside of this. It can feel very all-consuming, so it's really important as a parent that you keep going about your daily life as much as you can whilst also supporting your child. And also as a parent, it can be really draining and really emotionally really difficult to support a child who's struggling with their eating. So it's really important. That self-care of parents is really important. So keep doing things that kind of top up your bucket, so to speak. Meet with friends, go out, do things that you enjoy, and keep time just for you. And also try and keep time for other children in the family as well. Because it, you know, it can be all consuming by the very nature of it. In terms of sort of how to talk about it, how to respond to it, it can be really helpful to kind of separate the illness from your child. So by talking about it as the illness, the eating disorder, some people give it a name, anorexia might become Anna or Rex, you know, to kind of, as I say, separate it from the child, give it an identity of its own, because it can feel like your child has changed. It can feel to your child, they might feel that this has become them, but actually it's not. They're still your child under there, and you know, they're still who they were. It's just that this thing has come in and for the moment is kind of obscuring them a bit, but they are still there underneath. So to separate it out from the individual can be really helpful. Obviously, we live in a very much a diet culture. There's a lot that we are faced with about what we should eat, how we should look. So thinking about how we are, how we talk about our own bodies can be helpful. Thinking generally about how we talk about food and eating. So rather than talking about kind of appearance or looks, maybe talking about what food can do for us, so how it feels our body. So if I want to eat a donut, I'm going to eat a donut. I'm going to get that sugar hit. I need that quick energy hit. That's okay. So kind of all food is okay, is the message that we give. And trying to, so when somebody's struggling with eating difficulties, as I said earlier, it can affect their thought processes and how they'll respond. So trying to kind of avoid those confrontational type phrases. So you've not eaten your snack today, for example. Trying to turn it to something like, I've noticed that you haven't eaten your snack today. Is there anything I can do to help? Or something like that. So kind of taking out the you and kind of replacing with the I. I've noticed this, or I wonder this, or can sometimes help just avoid the person feeling attacked, I suppose, because the eating disorder will be really wanting to defend everything and to push everybody away. So it's very easy for the person experiencing to feel like they're coming under attack. And then obviously they kick back and respond to that. And that's when it can all blow up. So as I say, I appreciate, you know, sitting here, it's very easy to say it. And when you're in the situation, it's really hard to do. And we will get it wrong, you know, as parents, as humans, we get it wrong regularly, right? We're not perfect. Mm-hmm. We just do the best that we can for our child.
Do you sometimes have people that don't, that come across other people that don't understand that it is an illness, that they just say, oh, it's just a, like, you know, I've got, my daughter's autistic and she struggles with food. And a lot of people, not a lot of people, but some people I've come across have said, she, why is she being funny about that? You know, she should, well, why didn't she just eat it? That can't be anything to do. That's just being fussy. And you're just like, oh, come on. You know, it's not, you know, she can't eat it. She, you know, it's actually part of her condition. You know, it's something to do. And the same with eating disorders. It's an illness. And how do you as a parent explain that, you know, perhaps to somebody who's a bit older, who doesn't necessarily understand that it is an illness?
Yeah, it is really difficult because you can't stop people in the moment saying what they say, can you?
No.
But it's about, I guess, just explaining perhaps when your child's not there. So, you know, finding a time to speak with, be it a family member, whoever, and just explaining the situation and actually acknowledging that to them it might seem like nothing, it might seem like there's an easy fix to this, but actually explaining that it is a very serious mental illness. And there isn't a quick fix. It's not for attention, it's not for any reason like that, but it is really difficult for the person to be dealing with it. And actually what they need is just to be able to go about what they need to do without feeling like people are watching or commenting or spotlighting them. And trying to help people to understand that it is, as you say, it's an illness. It's not a fad. It's not a phase. It's not, it's a really serious illness.
Sadly, I do think a lot of people think that eating disorders, even now, even with all, you know, the information and knowledge that we have, I still think that people think it's just, but then I think that's the case with a lot of mental illness still. People think that it's just fads and phases and people will just snap out of it without, and they're just being a bit, you know, dramatic and, like you say, looking for some attention, which is a real shame.
I think one of my things is, obviously, we're talking from little through to teenage. How is, if there's a parent listening who has a very young child who is potentially going through one of their more picky, choosy phases of feeding, which they all do and they will continue to do. How do you how as a parent do you not panic potentially about your 4 or 5-year-old being like, I don't like that, I don't want that, or going through a phase and not going, there's something wrong, and being able, I think, to still remain calm around meal times and food, because I think food is so triggering. And we did a podcast about weaning, and we talk about the fact that we love to feed people. It's naturally you enjoy giving food to people and them enjoying it, and then when your child spits it out, doesn't want it, doesn't like it,
and you get really you've made it.
Yeah,
but I think if, and potentially as a parent, if you have had a tricky time with food as a child, or even more so that you've had an eating disorder, how do you then support your children or child through that without that kind of worry and the panic? And how do you sort of make that balance, I suppose? Because
what you're potentially worrying about is, like, at that young age, we were talking, weren't they, what you're doing is teaching life skills, and you don't want to mess it up, do you? That's what you worry about. Yeah.
I mean, there's so much pressure on parents, isn't there, to get it right generally, but particularly with food and eating. And yeah, so it is really difficult. I mean, you know, the main thing is kind of to get the message that any food is good food. So if your child is only eating a very limited diet, that actually they're happy, they're healthy, they're active, you know, they are getting the nutrients that they need somewhere. And I think if you're concerned physically, then obviously it's taking them for a medical checkup. But I think it's about, you know, acknowledging that there are times when it can be really frustrating and really, you know, you might lose your rag, you know, but trying to just keep it kind of as level, as calm as possible, as normal as possible, offering choices, just keep, you know, that patience. But actually, you know, at the end of the day, people need to eat, a child needs to eat to thrive and to survive. So whilst it is about kind of offering choices, about keeping it on the level, keeping it calm, there does come a point where they do need to eat. So there is a point, we work a lot with our parents on something called distress tolerance. So actually being able to deal with those difficult times when you have to have those difficult conversations. I'm talking more about teenagers than youngsters now. That actually you do have to eat to survive. That's the bottom line. And so what can we do? How can we help you to do this? So when they're younger children, like you were just talking about, Claire, it's about kind of just sowing those seeds actually, and keeping meal types as stress-free as possible. Sometimes kind of gritting your teeth and bearing it if you're offering them different things and they're saying, no, it's being thrown, you know, spat out or whatever. Just trying to get through and absorb it, and just any food is good food. So if you can get them to eat anything, you know, that's a good thing. If your child can't tolerate being sat upright in a chair, maybe look at bending the rules and perhaps eating somewhere else, or perhaps with a distraction like the TV on, or maybe listening to music through headphones, that kind of thing, to try and find ways that work for your child. And it doesn't mean that you're then setting them up with bad habits, in inverted commas, for life. It just means that you're helping them to feel comfortable when they're eating and feel comfortable around food.
It's such a minefield, isn't it? Because ultimately you can't make someone eat.
No.
You just can't. And I think that's the hardest thing, is if you can see, particularly a teenager, if you can see them losing weight and everything else, and all you want to do is you just know if they ate that they would, and you can't make that happen. And I can't imagine what it feels like. One, for the teenage, you know, for the person going through it, but also for the parent. Mm-hmm. And I think one other thing that's just sort of come into my head is it quite an even kind of across male and female to have eat? Because I think very often it's all focused around women and young girls.
That's what you immediately think of. I've only thought of, as we've been talking, I've only had girls in my head, and, funny enough.
Yeah.
And I am kind of aware that the amount of boys or males that are now experiencing challenges with food is in much more kind of prevalent, I think.
So eating disorders can affect anybody, and actually you can't tell just by looking at somebody if they've got an eating disorder, disordered eating. You know, there's no set kind of type or set person. It does affect males as well as females. I think, you know, the numbers of males impacted statistically are lower than females, but actually we don't know how much that is to do with the fact that perhaps males find it harder to talk about. So probably there's more males who are impacted than the statistics might show. At the moment, particularly with teenage boys, and I've got a 15, nearly 16-year-old son myself, there's a lot of sort of bigorexia type things, so where it's sort of bulking, wanting to get muscles, so that is a big pressure at the moment for adolescent males in particular. But you know, men can be as affected as women with any kind of eating disorder, restrictive eating, binge eating, bulimia type presentations. They affect everybody.
So is that a name for the bigorexia?
It's kind of, I'm not sure that it's a diagnosable whatever word is name. It's kind of colloquial, but so when people become very fixated on the size or the shape of their muscles, and it's a bit like with body dysmorphia, where people will fixate on parts of their body and perhaps see something very different from what other people see, bigorexia is very similar. So although this person might have very extended muscles and very defined muscles, they don't see that themselves. So they're constantly striving to sort of bulk up.
I don't think I've ever seen so many protein powders now. As that's massive. Like, that wasn't even a thing, and now
everybody's talking about protein. Every food that you see in the supermarket has got a protein label shouting out at you, hasn't
and
it
at the, and you see at the gym, everyone's drinking they come with like their protein shakes, and you're like, I don't think I've ever, you know, it's just such, and it is,
and you are fighting against that, aren't you, all the time with that kind of
and
thing.
We've got social media as well, which we didn't have before, so again, it has its benefits and its, you know, drawbacks, but being able to see and people constantly telling you, if you, you know, drink this, eat this, do this, you get these results for a very young mind, that, well, I don't even think it's a young mind. We're bought
overwhelming
into most of the things.
We are. Exactly.
It is difficult, and we're, you know, we're constantly fed, aren't we, this appearance ideal, you know, how we should look, and, you know, it's really hard. It's hard enough, as you just said, as an adult to filter that. So when you're a child or a young person trying to filter that, you know, even more difficult.
Well, you ask any woman probably listening, if they haven't tried collagen of some description or somewhere, it's just because it's all over, you know. So you go, I've tried that because that's what I saw. And so if you're a teenage boy who's on TikTok or Instagram or whatever, and all you see is protein powders, but everyone bulking up, and that's what you want to do, you're gonna you're gonna want to try it, aren't you?
Give it a go. So just to finish up, Hannah, what would be your biggest piece of advice to a parent with a teenager you're worried about? If there was one thing you could say to those parents, what would you say to them?
Well, one thing.
You could say more than one thing. Maybe three things.
So I think it's actually to hear that, yes, this is a really difficult time. It's a really difficult illness. But it is very possible to get through it and for people to recover from it. I'm quite conscious that we've spoken a lot about the negatives of it. And of course, there are a lot because it is a very difficult illness. But actually, people do recover and it is possible for people to recover and to go on and live the rest of their lives with it not being an issue. It's a hard road to recovery often, but finding it early, so we're talking within 2 to 3 years, means the chances of recovery are so much greater. I think as a parent, to not be afraid to ask for help with your child, to try and keep those channels of communication open with your child as much as you can. So if you can keep your child talking to you, even, you know, a little bit, and kind of talking with them about how they're feeling, what they're going through, is really helpful for your child. And actually to show your child that you notice and you recognize that they're struggling, and that, you know, what can we do to help with that?
Well, thank you, Hannah. I'm sure that there's lots of people that are going to find this really useful. And we'll put, I know that you said earlier about how people could find information about SWEDA. So we'll put all of those links in the show notes, and obviously links to social media and things like that. But thanks ever so much.
Thank you.
For your time. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been good to talk to you. Thank you.
That's everything for today. Thanks for listening. If there's something you'd like us to talk about, we'd love you to get in touch and let us know. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at Bespoke Family, or head to our website. The links are in our show notes.
Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next episode, and please give us a rating or review if you like what you hear. We're Bex and Claire, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Newborn to Teen and Everything in Between. See you then.